There is very good data from the National Institute for Health suggesting that people who have PhD in biomedical sciences, the unemployment rate is less than 2%. So people who have gone to and done PhDs do really quite well. Field general-wise in biomedical sciences, 42% of those who have PhDs in the, between the last 6 and 9 years are in academia, and about 18% or so are in biotech companies, and a small fraction, maybe 8 or 9%, in non-science fields.
Welcome to Neurotransmissions. I'm Misha.
I'm Ben.
And today we have a guest host with us. Hi, Audrey.
Hi.
Dr. Audrey Bonin works with us here. She is a postdoc at Max Planck, Florida. And Audrey, could you tell us a little bit about what you do?
Yes. So as you just said, I'm a postdoc at MPFI in Jason Christie's lab, and I'm studying the cellular basis of cerebellar dependent motor learning.
Okay. Accent, New Jersey?
France.
Okay. So today we'll be sitting down with Kamran Khodoka, and he is the department chair of neuroscience at the Albert Einstein Institute. And he studies the cerebellum. The cerebellum is something that we learn about in grad school as a part of the brain that is mostly responsible for coordinated motor movement.
Mostly,
right?
As we might find out today.
That's right. We learn that, you know, deficiencies in this area, for example, Korsakoff syndrome caused by too much drinking, gives you really poor coordination. You start wobbling around. But it turns out that's not the only thing that happens.
What else happens?
Well, when you get damage to your cerebellum, you kind of turn into a rude jerk. And there are lots of different behavioral things that happen, and we're going to ask Kamran about that. We're sitting down today with Dr. Kamran Khodoka. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
So would you mind telling us a little bit about what you do for your research?
Yes, my interests are to understand what the cerebellum, the little brain, does for a living. And my aspirations in life is to show everybody in the field of neuroscience that the little brain rules the big brain. And that all of you guys who are working on different parts of the brain are missing out by not working on the cerebellum.
So the cerebellum, I think, as most of us learned about it in graduate school, is responsible for a lot of our coordinated motor movement. But I think you try to make the argument that it's not just that, and as a matter of fact, it does way more than that.
Absolutely. And actually, I have to be quite clear. I'm not the first person who come up with this idea. This is a long history. And to tell the truth, one of the greatest things about science is reading the history of the ideas and how things came about. And even the very concept, the dogma that cerebellum is only involved in motor coordination and not motor initiation, has been a subject of dispute for about 200 years. I don't know whether you're familiar, the first set of experiments done to ask what the cerebellum does were the kind where an Italian scientist stimulated different parts of the brain, and when he stimulated the cerebellum, he actually saw massive movements. So he suggested that the cerebellum is the site of movement initiation. And then 20, 30 years later, a Frenchie came and said, Italians don't know anything about physiology. And the way to do the experiments is to remove parts of the brain and see what you can't do. And when Jean-Pierre Flourens removed cerebellum, the animals could move, but they were not coordinated. So that was repeated by an American, John Call Dalton, a physician in Colombia, who, like everything else, Americans took credit for it and came up with the dogma that cerebellum is required for motor coordination. But since then, actually, there have been a large number of experiments done in non-human primates, in dogs, cats, alligators, pigeons, humans. There are some reports from neurosurgeons that if you were to stimulate the cerebellum, you get movement. So even the very concept that cerebellum is only there for motor coordination And not motor initiation is not correct. Now, with respect to whether it has a non-motor task as well, there has been a long history as to whether the cerebellum is or is not involved. And like any good question in science, has been controversial for decades. From long time ago, we have had evidence that if there is significant damage to cerebellum, a large part of the cerebellum, one not only sees ataxia, but changes in the behavior of the patients.
So this would be the focal point for the controversy in the history? Like, can what would be the sort of the earliest evidence you, or earliest point in time you think where the controversy began, given the particularly like the surmounted evidence of cerebellum and motor functions?
Oh, that's a really good point. I don't think I know the literature well enough to tell you when is the earliest point. I think Gordon Holmes, who was a British physician who tended to soldiers, had some idea of this. He is credited, rightly so, for correlating damage to different parts of the cerebellum with the different things that we can cannot do. This came as a consequence of gun wounds during the World War. But the idea of that you not only can have dysmetria of movement when you have a cerebellum damage, but also dysmetria of thought has been around for 50, 60 years at the minimum. And Jeremy Shoneman is at Harvard, at MGH, is one of the people who has very much pioneered this thought. He coined a terminology for sort of behavioral symptoms that one gets, a cerebellar affective disorder, when there is damage to the cerebellum or when the cerebellum or large parts of the cerebellum are resected following surgery, say if a patient had tumors or something along those lines. And since then, there has been a great deal of evidence to suggest cerebellum does have a bunch of non-motor tasks. So, for example, Peter Strick, a fantastic anatomist and physiologist, has provided very good evidence. For example, it was a Nature paper, if I remember, maybe 10, 15 years ago, that cerebellum sends projections to parts of the cortex which are related to language processing. And defects in language, in speech, after surgical removal of cerebellum is a common finding. The problem that we have had in the field of brain science as a whole, and something that even optogenetics is perhaps exaggerating as a problem, is that the brain is very much heavily interconnected. So when you do something to one part, when you activate one part or damage one part, it is very hard to be absolutely certain that it is that location that is responsible for that defect or effect, because it could be that it's propagating to different parts of the brain. So by and large, many things that one has seen related to changes in cerebral activity had been considered to be compensatory in nature rather than being causal. And it is only now that we're just slowly gathering more evidence that maybe it's not compensation, and for many of these, cerebellum may have a causal role.
Can I just step back a little bit? Because you said something interesting about that made me think that about, you've got these projections that could go to the language area, right? But a lot of, I guess what's interesting about that is that a lot of what our brains have evolved to do is to take a sensory is to take input from the world to generate a motor output.
Yes.
Right. So language is cognition, but it's also heavily intricated with motor function because it's intertwined, much as like most of our vision and stuff like that. So in many cases, I guess you could make the argument that it would make sense from the motor perspective that the cerebellum would be sending projections to the language area, maybe, but maybe not sort of like, maybe premotor, where you're doing a planning, but you haven't actually made the movie, not in the process of making motor. So are there examples that are more higher level cognitive?
You're making an excellent point, and hence one of the problems in the field as to, well, you know, you're absolutely right. In order for us to report anything, like what do we think, you have to use your mouse to move it, you have to put your tongue in precise locations to speak. So, hey, where is the surprise? Cerebellum needs to be involved there, right? these have been topic of enormously hot debate for a long time. But I'll give you some examples of experiments done that suggested that cerebellum was involved in cognition rather than simply in
sensory motor and
sensory motor. So I give you two examples. One of them had a slight fault with the experiment. The other one tried to rectify that issue. So an experiment was done where subjects were asked to put their hands inside black dark bags, and in those bags there were marbles of different size and different texture. And they were asked to pick one of the marbles at a time and roll it around on their fingertips. And fMRI was done to see which parts of the brain are active. And as one might suggest or imagine, you're doing some controlled movement, so cerebellum was lighting up. The same subjects were then asked, okay, you need to slightly modify the task. You should do exactly the same movements, except at the end of this, I will ask you, tell me about these marbles, which one was bigger, which was round, which one had different textures. And when the subjects were supposed to perform that task, where movement-wise was almost identical, the cerebellum really lit up. It showed tremendous activity. Now, the argument was made in that paper, I think it was a Nature paper or a Science paper, that, hey, cerebellum is important for cognition. But then others came and quite rightly said, well, you never know, because if you're trying to find differences, maybe you coordinated the movement of your fingers differently and with thought and things, and there were much finer movements, and therefore that's why the cerebellum lights up. So then a modified version of this experiment was done, this time in non-human primates, where their hands were put flat down on the table and tied down gently, and sandpaper of different coarseness was rubbed on the tips of the fingertips. And they looked at to see, you know, how much signal do you see in the cerebellum. And a slight amount of signal came up because there are projections from your proprioception to the cerebellum. But then, in the next series of tasks, exactly the same thing was done, but the monkey later on had to indicate which one was more or less coarse. There was, again, no movement in the hand whatsoever, and there the cerebellum lit up again like a Christmas tree. And those sort of experiments tried very hard to dissect away the motor component from the cognitive component. And I would say that the literature is peppered with a great deal of very good data to suggest for a long time that cerebellum has been involved in cognitive processing.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess that was also shown by fMRI studies later on humans also.
Absolutely.
Where you have probably a better control as to if it's involved in cognition or motor functions.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So when we're talking about these specific, for example, with cerebellar affective disorder,
yes,
with cognitive effects that we see in patients that have transected cerebellum, what kind of symptoms do you see in those patients?
So Jeremy is the person to look up for the reviews and the many papers that he has written on it, and he is very eloquent in the way he writes and describes them. But there are many things that happen in patients in the subjects that are in common. One of them is difficulty in predicting what is the right reaction, and I use the words carefully and on purpose. One of the things we think cerebellum does in general is prediction of time, prediction of movement. So prediction of a response could be along the same lines. And these subjects, after resection, have a poor measure of what is an appropriate response. If you ask them a question, for example, draw for me what time it is, some of them go on forever drawing these delicate things, and without understanding that this was a simple question to judge how well am I functioning. I just needed to draw a couple of the small hand and large hand and point to the time, right? And a grandiose grandfather clock with a cuckoo bird coming out of it. Similarly, they become somewhat reserved and less willing to engage with you in interactions. That sometimes it's thought that they come across as being very rude. They're no longer looking at you in the eyes and engaging you with interactions. So there has been a great deal of data and information from individual subjects to suggest that there is a major change in the mood and behavior of the patients. But as we'd appreciate, it's kind of a hard thing to do. With every patient is different. Resections are different parts of the cerebellum. So this is not, quote, an experiment you can do. It's just observations that you make from a number of people at different ages with different medications, etc.
So when it does come to the experiments that you can do, can you tell us a little bit about how you study the... how you study the phenomena related to cerebellum in your own lab?
Yeah. So in the past year and a half, we have been interested in exploring a potential mechanism by which cerebellum might affect the dopaminergic reward pathway. And again, I have to say that we were not the first to think about this and come about with this idea. For a long time, we have known that damage to the cerebellum or cerebellar defects could be a risk factor for autism, could be a risk factor for schizophrenia, and also in many forms of addictive behavior. And I can say that with confidence now after looking at the literature, but I did not know many of these myself a year ago. So these are things that are not commonly known in terms of cerebellar function because we don't speak of them because we don't think cerebellum could be involved in non-motor tasks. My interest, my lab's interest, actually looking at VTA, to be perfectly honest, was because of serendipity. We were following projections from cerebellum to the thalamus and then basal ganglia for a different project we were doing with respect to the role of cerebellum in various forms of inherited dystonias and how cerebellum can rapidly modulate the basal ganglia, and keen observations led us to conclude that the projection from cerebellum were not only going to the thalamus, but also to the ventral tegmental area. So a prep scholar in my lab, Shanad, started doing experiments in anesthetized mice using optogenetics to ask the question, do indeed cerebellar fibers make projections to VTA, and can their activity alter function of the VTA neurons? And we had very good data to suggest that that were the case. We were concerned with use of anesthesia in our animals, so then the whole project evolved of using awake mice, and we convinced ourselves with a number of different techniques using anatomy, using viral tracing, herpes virus that can jump synapses, using the slice electrophysiology combined with optogenetics, and in vivo recordings that, yes, there is indeed a powerful connection from cerebellum to VTA. But the question was, is this synapse, are these projections powerful enough to affect behavior? And we have used a bunch of behavioral studies to manipulate, either activate or inactivate the cerebellar projections to the VTA to ask the question, is behavior of the animal modified? And today we find that that is indeed the case. Now, this is all with a caveat that you all appreciate that when you optogenetically activate the fibers in the VTA, it could be backpropagating and having collaterals and moved into a different brain region. So the most parsimonious interpretation in our minds, given the fact that we can locally inactivate the fibers too, is that it's contacting the VTA, but we cannot rule out at this moment other more tortuous paths for activation of different brain regions.
Could you maybe tell us a bit more about what does it mean regarding the role of the cerebellum in psychiatric diseases?
Sure, I can speculate. as I'm sure you know, the ventral tegmental area is one of the major dopaminergic pathways in the brain. And it sends dopaminergic projections to a number of regions, including nucleus accumbens, which is involved in motivational behavior, and prefrontal cortex, which is involved in affect and the way we think. And for example, for schizophrenia, there are some thoughts that is the disbalance of dopaminergic system in the prefrontal cortex that might be responsible for some of the negative effects. And similarly, it is plausible that alterations in dopaminergic signaling from VTA to nucleus accumbens might be involved in some of the social defects in AST, autism spectrum disorder. So the fact that a part of the brain, cerebellum, which has been implicated in both of these disorders, sends projections to the VTA and might be in a position to alter dopaminergic activity in the nucleus accumbens and prefrontal cortex, might provide one of the mechanisms by which cerebellum could be involved in these disorders.
I think I was interested if you might speculate more on this interaction between the cerebellum and VT. So, I mean, you have this evidence that there's this direct projection, and earlier you mentioned that, or you stated that, and as we know, that the cerebellum is often thought of this predictive coding structure that is sort of predicting motor or potentially motor movements related to cognitive thought. And so do you have any thoughts about what predictive strategies might be employed here, what predictions the cerebellum might be giving to the dopamine pathway and the reward system?
Yeah, it will be purely speculative, but let me just speculate. So one might put it together or think about this in the context of the function of cerebellum overall. If you go back with the thoughts that we have had as to how cerebellum computes, the ideas are that it is an organ, it is a part of the brain that receives all the different sensory modality you can think about from all over your body parts, all over the cortical areas. And perhaps that's the reason why it has half the neuron's entire brain, because it has to integrate all these different sensory and cortical inputs, and it will use those patterns of input to make a decision, an output from the precognitive cells and then from the CN neurons as to what the next action might be. And that's why it's predictive. It is associating, perhaps with a number of learning components to fine-tune the system, as to what different sensory cues and cortical thoughts, if you want to put it, would mean in terms of coming action. So in terms of motor control, that's very simple. If my joint has a certain angle and my arms or my muscles are contracting at a certain rate, I need to now flex or contract my fingers to grab the bottle of water to pick it up. And that's something you need to do very fast and in a predictive manner to do smooth movements. So now let's think about, for argument's sake, but if cerebellum plays a role in, I don't know, social behavior. Let's imagine that you are thinking of going to a room and meeting a good friend. So to do so, if this is a good friend and you're excited and happy, you need to have some motivation. So you need to combine a bunch of inputs, the sensory cues and the thought that I'm about to proceed to a room to meet with my friend with a pleasant outcome. You're motivated to do so. So that could be the predictive manner of it. And as you enter the room, you see the cues become stronger and stronger and the reward component goes up. The only reason we are motivated to do something is because that action is rewarding. So for me, it's kind of, and I'm sure there were a lot of behavioral scientists who come and say, well, you're using the terms wrongly or loosely, but that's how I think about it in terms of how the cues could be helping the cerebellum to make a prediction, and this prediction is with respect to would the following thing that I'm going to do be rewarding or not.
Yeah, I mean, it almost seems like on a certain level, having a system that's closed loop is amenable to learning a motor skill, right? You know, teaching yourself to hit a baseball with a bat. You've never done it before. So you're going through these motor planning skills. You're trying to learn this particular movement. And the moment of which you've made the correct movement and you have that instant feedback that the cerebellum is probably providing in terms of trying to error predict the motion, it almost seems like it would be good to have a surge of dopamine to sort of entrain your brain that, okay, I've made the correct movement. This is the minimum error in this motor movement, and I'm now learning this thing that I'm trying to do. So self, sort of this, in a closed form, it makes a lot more sense, actually.
Absolutely. And then actually, there are a couple of other things to mention. Javier Medina had a really nice Nature Neuroscience paper a few months ago when he showed that in the process of eye blink conditioning, a form of learning where the cerebellum learns to associate cues, say a tone or a light, with an air puff that and the animal learns to close its eyes, the cerebellum manages to also signal the higher order learning, to signal the fact that the cue has arrived, not necessarily just the fact that the puff has arrived. And we didn't discuss this, but there is a good deal of literature in humans using fMRI, which suggests that cerebellar activity is heightened in drug abusers when they see cues relevant to their drug abuse. You know, if you show somebody a packet of cigarettes and they're an abstinence from smoking, or for heroin or cocaine, etc. And one might speculate that the same kind of learning that allows us to learn how to blink when a puff is about to come by associating the tone with the air puff might allow us to learn to associate the cue of a pack of cigarettes or a syringe with what might be receiving in terms of reward. And later on, once that we're trying to abstain and forego, it could be a cue that forces relapse or promotes relapse. And if that is the case, and we can do experiments to verify this hypothesis, it might provide a good venue by which we could therapeutically go after to prevent relapse or lessen relapse. And that's, again, why I really believe the little brain rules the big brain, and there is tremendous latitude there for manipulation.
I had a thought that, I mean, do you think that this would play out, this is more speculation, if you had, say, you know, in these studies where you have an animal who becomes addicted to cocaine only because it's just infused into the animal, like under the skin, rather than self-medication, where, because in one case you can imagine like a user, heroin user or cocaine addict goes through a set of motor actions in order to yes. use the drug, right? So there's motor actions associated with the disease, which so that sort of complicates in terms of thinking about the disease relationship and motor in the cerebellum. Whereas you might have an animal which you becomes addicted to a substance without any motor actions or with no correlated motor actions. I don't know if there's any studies that have been done or if whether you would expect the cerebellum to still play a role.
So we are gearing up. First, this morning, 5 o'clock, again, I woke up to work on my grant for National Institute for Drug Abuse for exactly answering the same kind of questions. And the experiments are fairly easy to do, right? So in one case, you will, as you suggested, the animal has to work for it. So you can have it, so it has to lever press to receive, for argument's sake, injection of cocaine. In another case, you can provide that passively yourself and then ask the questions, if I were to inactivate cerebellar fibers to VTA, can I prevent it from learning the one that requires active participation of animal by the motor, and not the other one? Can I also later on prevent association of the cue with that and prevent relapse, for example? So there are a good thing about some of the ideas that are coming about is that there are testable hypotheses, and given the current technology, we can go after them and resolve the questions.
So one of the things that you work with is the GRASS Foundation project. Could you tell us a little bit about your role there and what this project entails?
Sure. Actually, my role is almost irrelevant. I used to be a trustee of the GRASS Foundation, and now currently
I'm... Wait, sorry. Can we just, before you go into it, can you start by just... explaining what the GRASS Foundation
Absolutely.
Is. Let's start. I don't think it's ever been discussed, so.
You're right.
Sorry.
GRASS Foundation is one of the best things that happened to neuroscience. Let's just start from that. So the GRASS Foundation was started by Albert and Ellen GRASS, two amazing individuals who brought the EEG machine for the first time to the United States. So Albert was a great electronics expert, and Ellen was a scientist. They were at Harvard. And they realized very quickly that the field was suffering but not having a mechanism by which to record electrical activity in the brain. And their interest was epilepsy. So they developed the first EEG machine in the United States, and they were making this in the back of their home, in their garage. And there was a tremendously large market for it, so they started making more and more and more, and very quickly they managed to amass a good deal of fortune from this action. They very much believed in sharing. And so there are a number of stories about their generosity of, you know, somebody telling them, oh, I would love to do such and such experiments and don't have it, and Ellen putting one of these machines in the back of her car and next day delivering it as a gift. So being in close proximity to the Marine Biological Laboratory in Woods Hole, one of the things that they were really keen to do was to empower young people to do neuroscience. And one of the major hurdles then, again, was lack of equipment. So what they did was, in the first few years, was to encourage young neuroscientists to come to Woods Hole, Massachusetts, the Marine Biological Lab, and they rented for them lab space, and they provided these EEG machines for them to do experiments. And to make it as painless as possible, they paid for the entire family to come and for the entire time of the summer. They then, after a few years of doing this out of their own pocket, formed the Grass Foundation. They put a substantial amount of funds in them, and they formalized the program to the Grass Fellowship Program, where a number of people will apply, and they will have projects that initially were all based on neurophysiology, given that what the company could provide was electrophysiological equipment. And often in marine biology, because what Marine Biological Labs, MBL, had unlimited resource of was marine organisms. As I'm sure you know, much of what we know about the principles of neuroscience came from marine organisms, you know, looking at action potential in the squid giant axon, synaptic transmission at the squid giant synapse, the role of calcium channels, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a really powerful place to be. The program has evolved since then because we appreciate in the Grass Foundation that there are many questions that require use of, say, mammals like mice and rats, and MBL has evolved to be able to accommodate such species, and that there are more ways to address neuroscience than just neurophysiology. So what the program at the moment is that about a dozen people are accepted to the program. Their expenses and their families is paid to be at Woods Hole, Massachusetts, at the Marine Biological Labs for the entire summer from Memorial Day to Labor Day. We obtain for them all the equipment that they need for their research, and this comes about because of the generosity of the vendor. So we get the latest microscopes to photons, Pascalm amplifiers, you name it, lend to us by vendors such as Zeiss, Olympus, Thor Labs, Scientifica, etc., Axon Instruments. And the Grass Fellows learn first to put the equipment together on their own. They're little PIs. We have a laboratory called the Grass Laboratory. I'm the director of the Grass Labs at the moment. Each fellow will have its own corner, its own cubicle, and they put together their equipment. My job is to help if they ask for help. But often these guys, ladies and gentlemen, are highly motivated, extremely bright individuals who very quickly figure out how to put the rig together. And they were smart enough to ask for help, but they needed to. And they organize and they do their experiments for the summer. And we have had Grass Fellows who had come up with Nature papers at the end of their fellowship, and some that came up with preliminary data to write an R01 as they move on to become an assistant professor. We take all levels. It is best for those who are at the juncture, for a graduate student about to become a postdoc who was thinking of a second postdoc, assistant professor who's just started would like to have some preliminary data to get for their grants to submit. And in addition to allowing them to have independent research, it is a tremendous networking opportunity. Woods Hole is nerd paradise. It's one of the places where you have the highest density of really highly intellectuals walking around in shorts and t-shirts with their socks all the way up to their knees and sitting on the bench. And you can sit down on the bench and talk to someone, and 10 minutes later realize that she is a Nobel laureate. And you had no idea that was the case. So it really is a fantastic environment. There are fantastic seminars which are going on all the time. So it's a very empowering fellowship. And at the end of it, people come back extremely motivated, very tired, but extremely motivated to pursue their career in sciences. The Grass Foundation does a bunch of other things. You may have heard of the Grass Lecture at the Society for Neuroscience. It's one of the major lectures. We have endowed several things at the Epilepsy Foundation. We have the Milady Program for Latin American students coming to courses that we organize and coming to SFN. So we do a lot more than the Grass Fellowship Program, but the Grass Fellowship Program is our flagship program. The deadline is December, early December, and there is a website, I think it's grassfoundation.org, that I urge you guys to look at.
Yeah, we'll grab the website and and put it up there and add it in.
Is this so? People who tend to apply are these people from small labs that are generally lacking a specific resource that you can offer, or do you tend to also take people from big labs?
Oh no! So we have we look at the application in a holistic manner. The idea is to have as large of an impact in that person's career as possible. But we have many people from extremely big labs who have 5 2-photons in their own lab, but they want to be independent. They come and set up a 2-photon in the grass labs. At the same time, we have people coming from a small lab. So it is really complete mix. It is an international program. We have people coming from all over the world. I haven't come across a single person who might not benefit from this program. And we do not discriminate in any way against anybody.
Okay. So you are currently at the Albert Einstein Institute, and you are the department chair.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of both graduate students and especially postdocs who are looking into career opportunities right now, I think, would love to hear some advice. I mean, as we look to make the next transition in our careers to higher positions, as somebody who is in charge of a lot of hiring, what do you look for? What do you expect postdocs to have that sets them apart based on people you will hire and won't?
That's a good question, somewhat a hard question to answer, but I can tell you my perspective on it. So there are a number of things that I like to talk about first before giving that piece of my version of advice. First, I think scientists, particularly in the United States and throughout the world, are in a very privileged situation. You know, we are given funds, taxpayers' money, and salary to basically pursue our love and our hobbies. And I think that really is quite a privilege. I really cannot think of any other career for myself but being a scientist. I love what I do. I smile every morning I wake up and come to work. So it is fantastic. We have a certain obligation towards society, and that is to advance science. And I wouldn't even say that is to improve healthcare or thing, even though a great fraction of the money comes from the National Institute for Health, because as of now, our knowledge of the human mind and the brain and even the body is so primitive that it's very difficult a priori to know what is going to contribute to improvement in the healthcare. And many of the things that have had significant impact in health have been serendipitous findings that have come from research, including antibiotics and so forth. So, but we have an obligation to pay back to society and to educate the society, and that we are doing this because ultimately it is something that will be of value to the society. So given that privileged position, it is not surprising that perhaps it is not the highest paid job in the world, right? So many of us could be working in the pharmaceutical industry or become CEO of a transportation company and make a lot more money than we do in science. It is not also the least stressful job to have. So we are responsible often for bringing a large fraction of our own salary, and moreover, the salary of the people who work for us as PIs. And that's tremendous responsibility. And given the current funding climate, it can be very stressful because you can have an outstanding proposal, but with a funding rate of 9th percentile, there will be 91 grants that will not get funded, and at least half of them are outstanding. So it's clear that there will be fear amongst people as to whether they should enter the field or not. And this is where I want to put things to rest. There is very good data from the National Institute for Health suggesting that people who have PhD in biomedical sciences, the unemployment rate is less than 2%. So people who have gone to and done PhDs do really quite well. Field, general-wise, in environmental sciences, 42% of those who have PhDs between the last 6 and 9 years are in academia. And about 18% or so are in biotech companies, and a small fraction, maybe 8 or 9% in non-science fields. In neurosciences, things actually are really quite Interesting. So about 53% of those who have PhDs remain in academia, and they do really well. So things are not so dire. I know that it looks scary and hard. Things are not so dire. And on the basis of the numbers that I have seen that Walter Crutch, as the director of NINDS, was sharing just a few weeks ago with a subcommittee at SFN that I'm a member of, the number of unemployed for those who have a PhD in neuroscience is so low that it couldn't even show as a percentage. So, you know, there is still tremendous hope and future for people who are getting a PhD in neuroscience. Now, being a scientist is not easy. And one of the reasons it's not easy is because independent of how smart we are, nature is smarter. And we are not there yet with knowing exactly how the brain works. So many times you come up with a hypothesis, you think, hey, this is going to be it. And nature throws a curveball at you. And there are many times you do experiments that you are sure are going to work, and they work, but they give a different answer to what you expected. So given that, it is very important that people are in science for the right reason and that they can take the days where things don't work. Why am I bringing that up? Is because that is what I look for as a chair in hiring a person. I want to make sure that the person who comes is realistic.
Not only you have to keep up with it, but you have also to realize that sometimes when it doesn't work the way you think and you find a different answer, that will lead you to an even more interesting path.
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that I emphasize with my students and postdocs is that when things are complicated, it doesn't mean, oh, hell, what happened? It just means, oh, isn't that exciting? A more complicated puzzle. And I need to understand it more. So the most important thing from a chair's point of view is hiring someone who is going to be successful long term. And to be successful long term requires that that person was trained well as an independent scientist. It is very easy to do science and be told what to do as the next experiment, or even have evolved that you know what is the next figure or the next paper. But it's much longer to have a longer term view of science and where you want to go. And of course, given that science is so unpredictable, you need to be nimble and change direction. But what we look for most at Einstein, in our search committee, in my department, and myself, is identifying the people that not just have funding now, that's almost irrelevant. It's not totally irrelevant, but almost irrelevant. But people which we believe have a vision and are trained well enough to be able to be fast on their feet, and if the nature inevitably throws the curveballs at them, they can readjust and go forward. Now, there are some practical issues, right? So that's all poetic and sounds great, but there are some practical issues. The number of applications for each job at the moment is just so high that you have to make sure that you have a good CV. And the good CV, to a great extent, is the number of publications you have and whether you were a first author on that paper or the last of the contributing authors, not the sitting author. So it is important to have a good CV. It's important to have good papers. And it's important, again, to be able to think independently as a scientist.
Okay, well, unfortunately, that's all the time that we have. But thank you so much for sitting down and talking
to
us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you for reminding us why it's important to keep in mind how lucky we are to be scientists and why we should always think about why we love what we are doing.
Because it's easy to give advice on how to sort of, you know, add little tidbits to your CV and how to hack your way through. But realistically, the best way to do it, I guess, is to convey your excitement and to love what you do. And then, you know, you'll move on.
Yeah, it's pretty inspiring.
Yeah. I'm inspired by your face, Ben.
That's not going in the episode.
Okay. it is going in the episode, and now is the we can say goodbye to everybody. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Follow us at Neuropodcast on Twitter and at Neurotransmissions on Facebook. Thank you so much for the Scientific Communications Department here at Max Planck Florida, and everybody else who is involved in making this happen.
And thank you to our guest.
And thank you to our guest. And thank you, Audrey.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.